said around a mouthful of food. I've been hearing the damnedest things just now. Jean passed him the papers from Dexa and explained the situation as succinctly as possible. Locke ate with dexterous voracity, so that he was dunking his last biscuit in his coffee as Jean finished his report with innocuous hand signals. These two were upset, fixed now, used argument and drink, more of latter. Alas, said Locke, it was a grand old scheme we cooked up, but all we can do now is leave flowers on the grave and move along to the next one. Our Black Aris friends seem to be either sharper or luckier than usual these past few days. Well, leave that to me. I've got to hit back. He drained his coffee in one long gulp, then motioned for Jean and the two consailors to lean in closer to him. Dexa, he said quietly, Epitalis, you two must know all the other consail members fairly well. Which Black Aris consailor would you say has the most mercenary sort of self-interest? The least attachment to politics or ideology or anything beyond the feathers in their own nest?
The most aptly suited to bribery, said Epitalis.
Let's say the most open to clandestine persuasion, said Locke, by means financial or otherwise.
It would have to be a vault-filling sort of persuasion in any case, said Dexa. Rats don't tend to desert a ship that isn't sinking. Forgive that impression of the Black Aris, Master Lazari, but that's as I see it.
Don't worry about it, said Locke. But is there anyone?
If I had to wager something on the question, said Dexa, I'd put my money on Lovaris.
Second son Lovaris, said Epitalis, nodding. Also called Perspicacity, though gods know where that came from. He's got no real politics at all, near as I can tell. He loves the sound of his own voice, loves being one of the selected few, thoroughly adores the opportunities for enrichment a consail seat often attracts.
I'm an opportunity for enrichment, said Locke with a smile. I need to meet this piece of work privately, as soon as I can, and as secretly. How would you suggest I go about it?
Through Nikoros, said Dexa. Him and his underwriting for transport syndicates. Lavaris holds part interest in a ship called the Lady Emerald. If one of Nikoros' contacts carried him a sealed letter on some boring point of nautical business, you'd have his attention and you wouldn't need to fly Deep Roots colours anywhere near him.
That sounds damned superlative, damned superstition. Locke saluted her with his empty mug. I have my next mission. 6. 3 days later, a lean and scruffy man in a paint-spattered tunic emerged from the misty greenways of the Mara Kathani, where hanging lanterns swayed in the rain and Therin throne statues in crumbling alcoves gave themselves up slowly to the elements. Abutting the centuries-old park on its eastern side was the manse of Perspicacity Lavaris, Black Aris consail representative for the Bursadi district. The scruffy man knocked at the tradesfolk entrance and was let in by a dark-skinned hillock of a woman, grey-haired but dangerously light on her feet. The scuffed witchwood baton swinging from the woman's belt looked as though it had met some skulls in its time. She led the newcomer, still dripping wet, through the richly furnished passages of the house to a small high-ceilinged chamber where warm yellow light fell like a benediction. This illumination had nothing to do with the natural sky, of course. It was an arc of alchemical lamps above stained glass engraved with common symbols of the 12. The woman shoved the lean man up against one wall of the chamber, and for an instant he feared treachery. Then her strong, capable hands were sliding down his sides in a familiar fashion. Her search for weapons was thorough, but she was obviously unacquainted with the old Kamori trick of the hiltless stiletto dangled at the small of the back from a necklace chain. Locke had no illusions of kicking down doors and leaving a swath of dead foes in his wake if complications arose, but even a nail-scraping of an arsenal was a reassuring thing to have on hand.
"He's not armed," said the woman, smiling for the first time, "nor any threat if he were."
A middle-aged Therin man with pale hair and a seamy pink face entered the room. He and the woman traded places as smoothly as stage actors, and she eased the door shut on her way out.
"You can remove that nonsense on your head," said the man. At least I presume it's nonsense, if you're who you ought to be.
Locke pulled off his sopping wig of black curls and his ornamental optics, thick as the bottoms of alchemists' jars. He set them down on the room's only table, which had but one chair, on Lavaris' side.
"Sebastian Lazari," said Lavaris as he sat down with a soft grunt. "Lashani prodigy with no genuine history in Lashane. Doctor without accreditation. Solicitor without offices or former clients."
"The back trail's not up to my usual standards," said Locke. "No loss to admit it, since I didn't do the work myself."
"You and your bigger friend are interesting counterparts to the lovely Mistress Galante," said Lavaris, "though obviously not from the same place."
"Obviously," said Locke.
"I think you've come north from your usual habitations, Master Lazari. I heard rumors a few months ago, when the Archon of Tal Verar took that long fall off a narrow pedestal. Word was a few captains of intelligence managed to duck the noose and get misplaced in the shuffle."
"My compliments," said Locke. "But, you might as well know I didn't leave anyone behind me interested enough to chase me down, even if your entertaining theory were to reach the proper ears.
Nor shall I waste my time contacting them. The election will be passed before a letter could even reach Tal Verar. No, nothing we say here will be heard by anyone else save my forebears."
Lavaris gestured at the ornately carved nooks and drawers decorating the walls of the chamber.
"This is my family's memorial vault. 700 years in Carthane. We predate the presence. As for you, well, I've brought you here in answer to your interesting note because I wish to inconvenience you.
I'm sure your line hasn't survived for 7 centuries by refusing to carefully examine fresh opportunities," said Locke. "My note asked for nothing but this meeting. You have no idea what I'm about to offer you."
"Oh, but I do." Lavaris smiled without showing teeth. "You want me to consider a turn of the coat. Specifically, you want me to wait until all the votes are safely counted and I'm back in for the Black Iris. Then and only then would I announce that my conscience has forced me to join ranks with the Deep Roots. I understand you've promised to invent a convincing story, but you haven't told anyone else what it is yet."
Locke wanted to scream. Instead, he pretended to study the nails of his right hand and disguised his next deep, calming breath as a bored sigh.
"I'll have a passable excuse for you," he said, "and you would find the experience personally enriching."
"So I hear," said Lavaris. 10,000 ducats in gleaming gold. I supply a chest, you fill it before my eyes. On election night, the chest is to be kept at an allegedly neutral counting house by an equal number of my people and yours, until I undertake my public metamorphosis. Once I do so, your people walk away and leave mine the gold."
"Elegant, don't you think?" Locke wanted to punch the wall. This was too much. Lavaris had information from confidential conversations with Locke's half-dozen most trusted associates, information just a day or two old. Still, Locke had stayed calm through worse.
"Come now, Lavaris, we both know you're no ideologue. The whole city knows it. Nobody's going to be particularly surprised or hurt, and 10,000 ducats will buy an awful lot of anything."
"Do I look like a stranger to money?" said Lavaris.
"You look like a man of a certain age," said Locke. "How many more pleasant and healthy years will the gods give you? How much more pleasant and healthy could they be with that extra 10,000 to ease your way?"
"There is a more practical concern," said Lavaris. "Accepting a bribe is technically an amputation offence, perhaps even a capital one, if state interest can be invoked. Nobody pays attention to routine little exchanges, but 10,000 ducats is a very awkward mass of coin, and it doesn't fit any of the usual patterns. If I did this, I would be hounded by the Black Iris. I'd be the one man in Carthane to whom the bribery laws would be applied. The only place that money could vanish to is my cellars, I wouldn't be able to join it legally with my counting house funds for years, and that's damned inconvenient. Nor can I simply take a letter of credit for even more obvious reasons. If you can assume that I'm good for 10,000 in cold metal, said Locke, why don't I leave it to you to dictate how I can best conceal the transfer of funds to you?
I think not. Lavaris rose and stretched.
The most important point to consider is that your little scheme is only worth the trouble if we Black Iris win the election by exactly one consail seat. If you win, you've no need to buy me at all. And if we win by two seats or more, my turning can't shift the majority. Frankly, it's all immaterial, because I don't believe you're going to win. I don't believe you're going to lose by so little as one seat. You're correct that I'm no slave to ideology, but it would be tedious and stupid to suddenly find myself on the side of the minority.
Many interesting things could happen between now and the election, said Locke.
A hazy platitude. You might as well be conducting your business in public squares, Lazari. I've revealed how extensive our intelligence is because I want you to understand that you're over the barrel.
Fair enough, said Locke. This, then, is the point in the conversation where I say 20,000.
10,000 would be awkward enough. You expect me to be enthusiastic about trying to hide twice as much? The money's only an enticement if it can reach my pockets invisibly, and if I'm still relevant to Carthani politics after I've earned it. No, Master Lazari, I won't pretend I'm not ultimately for sale in some fashion, but you are not offering any sort of price I'm looking for. Now, before I have you escorted out, do you want a moment to put your wet disguise back on? For formality's sake, if nothing else?
7. A lean, scruffy man in a paint-stained tunic left the tradesman's entrance of the manse of Perspicacity Lavaris and hurried west, back into the cool green maze of the Mara Carthani. Subtle signs had been laid since his last passage, knots of brown cloth tied around hedge branches at knee level, and the man followed them rapidly through twistings and turnings, through brick arches hung with yellowing vines, to the sanctuary niche where Jean Tannen waited. Jean, clad in a sensible hooded oil cloak, was sitting on a bench beside the likeness of some forgotten scholar-soldier of the old empire, a stern woman carved in the traditional mode, carrying the raised lantern of learning in one hand and a clutch of barbed javelins on the opposite shoulder. Jean pulled out a second oil cloak and swept it over Locke's shoulders.
"Thank you," said Locke, pulling off his wig and optics. "We've got a serious hole in our security. Lavaris knew I was coming."
"Damn," said Jean. "Do you want me to roust those grandmothers Sabbathers got up on the rooftops after all?"
"Guards, they're harmless. Just there to taunt us. Our problem is someone inside Jostens. Lavaris had full details of my plan and my offer, things I've only mentioned to a handful of people in privacy in the past couple of days. Is there any place an eavesdropper could have their way with the Deep Roots private gallery?"
"I spent hours going over all the cellars, all the bolt holes," said Jean. "There's nowhere close enough, not above or below. And the noise of the place... No, I'd stake my life on it. It'd take... Well, it'd take magic."
"Then I'm off to hunt the rat," said Locke. "And since my first approach bounced right off the fatuous fucker's self-satisfaction, you'll have to visit Lavaris and try our second approach."
"Second approach, right." Jean rose from the bench. "You sure our budget can bear the strain?"
"It'll take us down to the dregs, and an emergency few thousand, and those donations from our Vadran refugees," said Locke. "But there's not much else to spend it on at this point, is there?"
"So be it," said Jean. "If he bites, I'll start visiting jewelers tonight. I've picked some discreet ones."
"Good. I'd say diamonds and emeralds, mostly, but you've got a sharp eye. Trust your own discretion."
"And we'll need a boat," said Jean.
"Already thinking on it," Locke tapped his own forehead. "But let's cover first, second, third, and fourth things before we go chasing down fifths or sixths, eh?"
"Gods keep you," said Jean. "Don't trip over your feet on the way home. What are you going to do about our rat?"
"Well, since someone we trust is feeding my confidential instructions to Sabitha," said Locke, "I reckon I might feed some confidential instructions to all the people we trust."
8. That night, as a hard rain beat down outside, Locke put his arm around first son Epitalus and drew the old man into a whispered conversation in the Deep Roots private gallery.
"You know more about the Issus Thedra than I do," said Locke. "I need a quiet, out-of-the-way place in your district to store some barrels of fire oil. A shack, a cellar, somewhere nobody will disturb, at least not before the election."
"Fire oil? What's this for, Master Lazari?"
"I'm going to see to it that our Black Iris friends have a fairly damaging fire a few nights before the election at one of their Bursadi district properties. I'll take pains to see that nobody gets hurt. I just want them to lose some papers and some comforts."
"Capital!"
Epitalus thumped his cane on the floor approvingly.
"Well, in that case, there's an outbuilding on my own estate, the old boathouse. I'm not using it at all."
"Good. One more thing, Epitalus. This is absolutely, vitally secret. Speak of this to no one. Am I clear?"
"As an empty glass, Master Lazari."
The reference left them both thirsty. They toasted the frustration of the Black Iris with small glasses of cinnamon lemon cordial, and then Jean reappeared from his errand, shrugging himself out of his rain-slick oil cloak. Locke waved Epitalus off, then conversed in whispers with Jean.
"We're on," said Jean. "I think Lavaris was perversely pleased by the idea of us doing our part tonight in the rain."
"Of course. He's a miserable sack of smugness. When?"
"Hour before midnight."
"Not much time if we're going to be careful."
"Time enough for me to arm myself with dinner and coffee," said Jean.
"Then I'll get the things we need from our rooms," said Locke. "You plant yourself in front of a fire and eat. Damn, here come Dexa and Nikoros, just the people I can't miss."
The two gentlemen bastards separated. Jean headed for the kitchens and Locke headed to intercept his targets and guide them up to the private gallery. He begged a moment alone with Nikoros first.
"Look, Master Lazari, here's the latest reports," said Nikoros, fumbling with his satchel as Locke pushed him toward a quiet corner. "We had a break-in last night at Cavril's office in the Ponta Corbessa. Nothing major, but I suspect they got away with some confidential minutes and voter lists. Our delegations to the temples paid for a public sacrifice for each of the 12. A lash and a silver compass for Morgante, a silk shroud for Azaguilla, a dove's heart for Preva."
"Nikoros," said Locke, "I'm devout. I know the usual sacrifices. Just tell me there were no complications."
"Well, the rain probably cut down on the crowds, but they all went well. The whole city knows we've done our duty to the gods and asked their blessing."
"If nobody got struck by lightning, I'm content. Now, I need you to get something for me, a hiding place, a shack, a cellar, a hole, anything, preferably deserted or disused, near the Vel Vespala, as close to the sign of the Black Iris as you can safely get. Do you know any spots?"
Well, let me think."
Nikoros rubbed his eyes and muttered to himself.
"There's a foreclosed chandlery that doesn't have a new tenant, about 3 blocks from the sign of the Black Iris. What should I do with it?"
"Just get me the place and I'll do the work," said Locke. "I'm going to repeat my stunt at the enemy tavern, smoke it up with harmless alchemy, only this time it's going to last hours and it's going to hit 'em at the worst possible time. I'll decide when that is, but I need my fire oil and powders stored nearby. This chandlery sounds perfect."
"As you wish, of course."
"And Nikoros," said Locke, "this is the deepest, darkest sort of secret. Don't write any notes or take any minutes on it. Keep this between you and me and the gods. Absolutely nobody else. Understood?"
"Perfectly, Master Lazari."
"Good. Off on your other business now and send Dexa over to me as you go."
"Master Lazari," she said, waving her cigar at him, "you look busy. Can't say I disapprove. What did you want to see me about?"
"What we're going to discuss must remain absolutely confidential," whispered Locke, leaning in so close he was immersed in tendrils of her smoke. "You know the Issus Melia better than anyone. I need you to find me a shack or a cellar, a bolt hole of just about any sort, where I can store a certain quantity of..."
9. An hour before midnight, the rain flashed down like silver harp strings against the darkness. A lean man and a burly man stood beneath a snuffed lantern at the edge of the Mara Kathani. They watched the manse of Perspicacity Lavaris and shivered under their oil cloaks. "There she is," said Locke. A heavy, dark shape, sensibly dressed like themselves, emerged from the tradesfolk entrance and walked away from them, north, in the direction of the city streets.
"And if this is a trap?" said Jean.
"I took a precaution." Locke knelt to lift a light wooden crate onto his shoulders. Jean picked up another. "There should be a carriage running one green alchemical lamp about a block north of the manse. Two of our drivers and two of our guards watching for trouble. If we come running, they'll snatch us up and get us home."
"Good thought," said Jean, "assuming we can run. I hope this is the last risky stupidity we dive into before this mess is over. I'm not sure we can get much less cautious than this."
"May the crooked warden bless us for keeping him entertained," said Locke. "Let's go. What kind of housebreakers would we be if we didn't keep our appointment?" 10. Two more nights and the weather moderated. The sky took back its rain, and the soft, brisk wind off the Amethel felt like the kiss of cool silk. Milky moonlight spilled down on the Vel Vespala as Jean Tannen approached the sign of the Black Iris, calmly and openly. The foyer guards, not in the market for fresh concussions, actually held the inner doors open for him. Then came Vordratha.
"One of us must be dreaming," he said, halting Jean 3 paces into the lobby. "And I'm quite certain I'm awake. So I suggest you sleepwalk your silly ass back to some place they don't mind your smell."
"I'm here as an ambassador," said Jean, "touching on a personal matter of Mistress Galante's. Of course, I don't have an appointment, but she'll want to see me anyway."
"I'll tell you what," said Vordratha. "You're free to kneel and kiss one of my boots, in which case I might possibly consider relaying your petition."
"Friend Vordratha," said Jean with a smile, "in your capacity as Varina's major domo and all-around mirthless damp prick, you deserve congratulations. In your capacity as any sort of meaningful opposition to my fists, you're half a second of easy work."
"You're a crude bastard, Callus.
And you're still favoring lamentably tight breeches." Jean feigned a yawn. "I'll take the same 2 hostages my colleague did. I invite you to ponder the difference in our sizes and proportional strength of grip."
Vordratha showed Jean to the now familiar private dining hall, warned him that the wait might be lengthy, and slammed the door behind him. Time passed, and Jean paced quietly, alert for trouble. He estimated it was 1/4 hour before the door opened again and Sabitha came in. She was dressed mostly in black, black tunic and breeches under a heavy, mantled black coat with silver buttons and chasings. Her hair was loose and wind-whipped, her white scarf hanging in folds around her neck, her boots covered in fresh mud. Not for the first time, Jean felt a strange sense of displacement as his memories of Sabitha tangled with the woman before his eyes. It was like looking at a reverse ghost, a reality somehow less tangible than the recollections 5 years gone. He'd lived those 5 years so gradually, but to his eyes she'd received them all at once, and in studying the new lines time had sketched for her, he felt the faint tug of his own passing years, like a weight in his heart. How much older did he look to her? He took a deep breath, banishing the broody thought. While Jean was often bemused by the philosophical notions that made free with his heart and head, long hours of tutelage in arms had also given him the trick of shoving such notions aside, cubbyholing them for contemplation once he'd survived his immediate responsibilities. Sabitha pressed herself back against the door, closing it, and folded her arms.
"If this continues," she said, "Vordratha might become the first man in the history of the world to have himself made into a eunuch for reasons of self-defense."
"In fairness," said Jean, "I can't imagine he's ever found much use for the blighted things."
"He's a devoted father of 7.
"You're joking."
"I was as surprised as you. Seems he's equally dedicated to his children and his career as a professional asshole. Please don't actually hurt him again.
My oath to the crooked warden, said Jean. He pulled an envelope from within his coat. Now, to why I came. This, well, I don't want to speak for him, but you ought to know it's taken him a few nights to finish this. Much lost sleep and many false starts.
As it was in the beginning, I suppose.
She took the envelope with a hand that shook just enough for Jean to notice, then slipped it into her coat.
And is that it, then?
Had the question sounded tired, Jean would have taken it for a dismissal, but Sabitha sounded wistful, almost hurt. He cleared his throat.
Diplomacy and curiosity don't always mix, he said.
We're not strangers, Jean.
Jean slipped off his optics and made a show of polishing them against a coat sleeve while he considered his words.
All I can see, he said at last, is two people I care for being divided and ruled by the words of a stranger. This bullshit of patiences. I'm sorry, I didn't come to lecture you, but surely you can...
You delivered his letter, said Sabitha. Now you're inquiring into his business. Is Jean even here right now?
Jean I could speak to, but Locke's legate to my court, that man's business is dispensed with and the door is open.
Again, I'm sorry.
Jean realized that their physical situation had the look and feel of a standoff. So long as they both remained on their feet, informality and relaxation would be difficult to kindle. He eased himself into a chair.
You know that I worry about him. I worry about the pair of you, and I regret that I haven't, exactly paid you a social call since our return. When you first invited us here, I was a little cold.
You were preoccupied.
That's kind of you to suggest.
And then I dropped 20 harlings on your head and packed you off to sea.
Sabitha sat down and crossed her legs.
It couldn't have helped. I hope you don't think I was pleased you broke your nose.
You provided us with a comfortable ship, said Jean. Leaving it in the middle of the night was our decision. I was annoyed at the time, but I know it was just business.
Maybe there's been a little too much just business.
Sabitha fussed self-consciously with her gloves.
I kept your hatchets as a sort of assurance, and then as a sort of joke, and then I handed them to Locke like you were some kind of hireling. I would not have desired to give that impression.
God, Sabitha, I'm not made of porcelain. Look, we're not... We haven't been bad friends, merely absent ones, long apart. And if there are more difficult possible circumstances for a reunion, I'll eat my boots, cold, with mustard.
Now who's being kind? She said. I've missed you, personally and professionally.
I've missed you, said Jean, sharp edges and all. Life was always better with you around. Everyone around you catches your light. We're doing it now, even across the city, working against you. I haven't seen him like this, well, not for a long while, sick with worry and totally exhilarated.
The conversation turns to our mutual friend again.
Yes. I mean, look, let me say this much, please.
Jean took a deep breath and pushed on before she could interrupt.
He and I had a dangerous misunderstanding in Tel Verar. We both looked at the same thing, and we both made bad assumptions that led us in opposite directions. We got lucky, but bad assumptions, they're a possibility to be aware of, you see?
Jean,
she spoke haltingly, each word crisp and fragile.
You must trust. Do I seem at ease to you? Do I seem wholly myself? You must trust that I have reasons, urgent reasons for my behavior, and that they are as much to my grief as they are to his.
Stop! Jean raised his hands placatingly. Sabitha, however damned foolish I think you're being, you do have a right to your own judgment. I don't like the judgment, but I'll respect the right all the way to my grave. I've said my piece.
Thank you,
she said, and her smile warmed him like a fire.
It seems you and he have both grown more diplomatic since we parted.
We've made second careers out of finding excuses not to murder one another. It's had a salutary effect on our manners.
Jean found his feet again and held out his hand.
Sister bastard, I'd like to detain you longer and make my job that much easier, but I imagine we're being watched. We can't afford to try the patience of our employers.
Brother Bastard, she took his hand and squeezed it. I wish I didn't have to agree. Thank you for talking to me.
I hope we get to do it again.
One day at a time, she said softly, until we find out what's waiting at the end of all this. But hope is a good word. I hope you're right about everything.
Is there any message I can take back for you?
No, she said. Whatever there is to say, I'll say it myself, in my own time.
They embraced, and Jean swept her off her feet. She laughed, and he turned the sweep into a complete twirl that ended with her elegantly set down atop a table. He bowed.
I return, madam, to the pedestal on which she usually resides.
You cheeky lump! And here I was almost feeling sorry about trouncing the bright red fuck out of you in the election.
Tsk! Whatever you are, you're not the least bit sorry, said Jean, waving as he let himself out. As you said, we're not strangers.
11. The room, so warmly lit, so invitingly decorated, felt cold after the door closed behind Jean. Strange how the empty seats and unused tables suddenly contrived to give the place the air of a deserted temple. Sabitha had never felt so isolated here before. She leapt off the table and landed softly on the toes of her boots, scarf and coat rustling. The envelope was out of her pocket before she knew it, hands moving faster than the thoughts that usually ruled them.
"Of course I'm not alone," she said. "You're here."
The room was still. The bustle of Black Iris business could be heard only faintly through the floor.
"I am a grown woman having a conversation with an envelope," she muttered several heartbeats later.
He was there like smoke, like a ghost in the room, like a scent in her clothing. It had been so long that she had forgotten the actual scent, only that she remembered carrying it, remembered wanting it, then not wanting it, then wanting it again despite herself. There were two locks, she thought, turning the envelope back and forth in her hands, two real locks under all the faces he wore in the course of his games. One of them put such a sweet, sharp ache in her heart she could scarcely believe that a younger, softer Sabitha had sealed the feeling away and managed to leave. That man broke all the patterns of law and custom and dared the world to damn him for it. The other lock, that man was bound tight to those patterns, their absolute prisoner. He would do thus because thus was the way it always had been in Camor, or the way it had always been for a garista, or for a priest, or a right person, or a gentleman bastard. The reasons were endless, and he would cling to them viciously, thoughtlessly, tangling everyone around him into the bargain. Even his eyes seemed different when he was that second man, and that was a problem. If there were two, might there not be three? Patterns behind the patterns, secrets behind the secrets, new strings to dance on, and these ones leading all the way back to the bonds magi of Carthane. Another lock, unknown even to himself. What would become of the locks she knew if that stranger inside them was real, if he woke up?
Which one of you wrote this?
She sniffed gently at the envelope, and the scent of it told her nothing. Everything about the room was suddenly wrong. She didn't want to be here in this quiet citadel, this orderly heart of her temporary power. The business between her and Locke was thieves' business. She needed a thief's freedom to face it, and a thief's most comfortable roof was the night sky. She swept an alchemical globe into her coat pocket and shook her boots off, scattering flakes of drying mud on the floor. Barefoot, she padded to one of the room's tall windows and cracked it open. Sabitha had adjusted the lock mechanism herself and rehearsed the process of slipping out many times. She'd mentally mapped four distinct routes around and down from the roof of the sign of the Black Iris. The stones beneath her feet were cool, but not yet unbearably cold. Up she went, night breeze stirring her hair, soft moonlight showing all her possible paths. The world of streets, alleys, horses, and lamps receded below her, and she grinned. She was 15 again, 10 again, hanging on ancient stones with nothing but skill between herself and the fall. She was on the roof, quiet as a sparrow's shadow, heart pounding not with exertion but with the thrill of her own easy competence and the anxious mystery of the envelope. Her rooftop sentry, crouched in the shadow of a tall chimney, all but exploded out of his shoes when Sabatha's hand fell lightly on his shoulder.
"Take a break,"
she whispered, straining to keep the sound of her smile out of her voice.
"Get some coffee and wait below for me to come fetch you."
As you say, Mistress Galante."
To his credit, he was tolerably silent as he moved off, not a patch on a proper Komori skulker, but willing to make an effort. Sabatha settled into his spot, pulled the alchemical light from her pocket, and once again turned the envelope over and over between her fingers.
"Get on with it,"
she said, knowing it was empty theater for an audience of one.
"Get on with it."
Minutes passed. Silver cloud shadows moved and blended across the dark rooftops. At last she found her hands taking the initiative from heart and mind again. The seal was cracked before she knew it. The letter slipped out. The handwriting was as familiar as her own. Her teeth were suddenly chattering.
"Damn it, woman, if you're vulnerable to him, it's because you wanted to let yourself be vulnerable. Get on with it."
"Dear Sabatha," she read, "I have instructed Jay to put this into your hands directly, and so presume to write your name selfishly. I want to say it out loud over and over again, but even alone in this little room I am afraid of sounding like a lunatic, afraid that you would somehow be able to sense me making a damned idiot of myself. At least, having written it, I can stare at it as long as I like. It keeps snatching my attention away. How can any other word I write expect to compete? This is going to be a long night. I suppose it's true to the peculiar course of our courtship that so much of my courting takes the form of apologies. I like to think I have some talent for them. Gods know I've had so many opportunities and reasons to practice. Sabatha, I am sorry. I have put my recollection of everything said and done since I came to Carthane under a magnifying lens, and I realize now that when I returned after escaping from your arranged vacation, I said some things I had no right to say. I took offense at your deception. I confused the business with the personal, and piled self-righteousness high enough to scrape the ceiling. For that, and not for the first time, I am deeply ashamed. It was wrong of me to throw such a fit." Sabatha sucked in cool air with an unseemly gasp, suddenly realizing she'd been holding her breath. What had she expected? It certainly wasn't this. "Once, you will recall, I told you that I gave you my absolute trust as my oath sister, my friend, and my lover. Absolute trust is something that can only be given without conditions or reservations, something that can only be rescinded if it was meaningless in the first place. I do not rescind it. I cannot rescind it. You tricked me fairly, using something I gave you freely. I am a fool for you not merely by instinct, but also by choice. I apologize now, not to beg for sympathy, but because it is an obligation of simple truth and affection I owe you before I have the right to say anything further. I have pondered so long and furiously on Patience's claims about my past that I have become thoroughly sick of the question. Though I desperately pray for the ultimate vindication of Jay's skepticism, I must admit I have no explanation that strikes me as convincing. There are shadows in my past that my memory cannot illuminate, and if you find that disturbing, I beg you to believe that I don't blame you. Patience's story has given us both a hard shock, and how I ought to deal with it is still something of a mystery. How you deal with it, I must and will leave to you, not out of despair or resignation, but in deference to my conscience, that broken clock which I believe is now chiming one of its occasional right hours. I will not question your reasons. It is enough for you to tell me that you wish to keep this distance between us, and it will always be enough. Know that a single word will bring me running, but unless and until it pleases you to give it, I will expect nothing, force nothing, and contrive nothing contrary to your wishes. I desire you as deeply as I ever have, but I understand that the fervor of a desire is irrelevant to its justice. I want your heart on merit, in mutual trust, or not at all, because I cannot bear to see you made uneasy by me. I have failed and disappointed you often enough before. Not for all the world would I do so again, and I leave it to you to tell me how to proceed, if and when you can, if and when you will. Willingly and faithfully yours, Loch Lamora." She turned the letter over, feeling ridiculous, looking for some other note or sentiment or mark. That was all there was. No pleading, no excuses, no demands or suggestions. Everything was now left to her, and that, more than anything, brought a tight, cold pressure to her chest and left her shaking. Failed her? She supposed that was true, if a touch ungenerous. The natural process of growing up was to stumble from failure to failure, and all the gentleman bastards had been prodigies of survival, not sensitivity. But disappoint her? The trouble with the skinny, bright-eyed bastard was that he kept refusing to do so. This letter was the work of the better Locke, the learning and giving Locke, the man who listened to her. Listened to her. What a banal sentiment it seemed in itself, but she'd been a woman of the world long enough to learn its rarity and desirability. It was amusing to use men like Catch the Duke pieces, but dupes listened with an ear for the main chance, for their own desires to be repeated back to them. After her years in the Marrows and this sojourn among the Adjusted, by the gods, Locke's company was more addictive than ever. A man who was proud and unpredictable and framed himself to her desires out of love and friendship rather than her own subterfuge. The corners of her vision misted. She rubbed the nascent tears away with her fingers, not gently, and sniffed haughtily. God's damn this whole stupid mess. Her heart was opened again like an old wound, but what was coming next? What did the bonds magi mean to happen to that man she loved? Was she being selfish in holding him at a distance, or was she being sensible, shielding herself against the worst that might be coming, and soon?
"Crooked Warden," she whispered, "if your sister Prava has any meaningful revelations that she's not using at the moment, would you let her know that I'm willing to be moved?"
Sabatha sighed. Be moved, certainly, but not move. Let the night be hers for a few more minutes. Let the business of the Black Iris click on like clockwork. Let the Magi sit on their own thumbs and spin. She read Locke's letter again, then stared out at the city, thoughts churning. The rooftop tapestry of moonlight and shadows and softly curling chimney smoke comforted her, but it had no answers to give. 12. 2 nights later, Locke and Jean sat together in the Deep Roots Gallery at Jostens, dining on birds abed, large morsels of several kinds of fowl on flaked pastry mattresses stuffed with spiced rice and leeks, then given covers of onion and sour cream sauce. To wash this down, they had flagons of sharp ale and piles of the usual notes and reports, which they discussed between bites. Less than a week remained, and the situation was spiraling appealingly out of control. Offices were being vandalized on both sides, party functionaries harassed or arrested by bluecoats on laughable pretexts, speakers and pamphleteers having shouting matches in the streets. Locke had dispatched a team of black-clad functionaries to hand out commemorative Black Iris treacle tarts in several marketplaces. The alchemical laxative mixed into the treacle was slow-acting but ultimately quite forceful, and many of the recipients had publicly expressed their lack of appreciation for the largesse of the Black Iris. Despite this, the odds commonly given remained 11-8 in the Black Iris' favor. However much Locke would have liked to shift this as far as possible with childish prankery, there was, realistically, nobody left in the city yet willing to accept baked sweets from a stranger.
"Oh, sirs, sirs!"
Nikoros appeared, still looking like a man fresh from a sleepless week on the road.
I am so sorry to intrude on your dinner, but I have some unfortunate news."
"First time for everything," said Locke lightly. "Go on, then, shock us."
"It's the chandlery, Master Lazari, the one that you asked me to secure in the Velves parlor, and the one where you and Master Callus packed away all the, alchemical items. 2 hours ago, stevedores in Black Iris livery entered the place and cleaned it out. They hauled everything away on drays to a location I haven't yet discovered."
Locke's fork hung in the air halfway to his lips. He stared at Nikoros for a second, then shared a brief, significant gaze with Jean.
"Ah, damn," he said at last, and took his bite of chicken.
"Damn. That's a fairly expensive loss, and a fine trick yanked right out of my sleeve."
"My most sincere apologies, Master Lazari."
"Bah, it's none of your doing," said Locke, wondering just what had made thoroughly subservient, eager puppy Nikoros, of all people, turn coat. Something to do with a Cadris withdrawal? Some failure of Bond's Magi sorcery? Poor old Falconer, tongueless and fingerless and comatose, was something of an argument against their infallibility. "Still," Locke continued, "the opposition seems to have a damnable grasp of where we're hiding our good toys these days. I want you to secure us a boat."
"Ah, a boat, Master Lazari?"
"Yes, something respectable. A barge, maybe a small pleasure yacht, if a party member has one available."
"Very, likely. May I ask to what end?"
"We took something from one of the Black Aris Conseil members," said Jean. "Family heirlooms of significant sentimental value. We'll return them after he's done us a favor. And we need the items in question to be absolutely secure until after election night," said Locke. "I'm not sure I can trust our current bolt holes, so let's try putting them on the water in something that can move."
"I'll get on it immediately," said Nikoros.
"Good man," said Locke, forking another bite of chicken. "Minimal crew, trusted sorts. They won't need to know what the boat is carrying. Master Callus and I will load the items ourselves." Nikoros hurried away.
"I wasn't expecting it to be him," whispered Jean.
"Nor me," said Locke, "and I'm dead curious to find out how she did it. But at least we know, and now we pin our hopes on the boat."
"To the boat,"
said Jean. They raised their ale flagons and drained them. 13. The night before the election, Locke leaned on a wall high atop the northernmost embankment of the Plaza Gandolo, looking out across the softly rippling water of the river and the lantern lights running across it like 100 splashes of color on a drunken artist's canvas. To his left loomed the sky vault span, swaying and singing suspension bridge, its four anchor towers uniquely crowned with balconies and sealed doors. Those doors were invisible from Locke's position hundreds of feet below, but he'd listened to Jostin describe them not an hour before. According to the innkeeper, the doors were as impervious to human arts as most Eldrin legacies, but a team of scholars and workers had once erected a climbing scaffold and tried to study them closely.
150 years ago, maybe, 8 folk went up, Jostin had muttered after looking around the bar. 6 came down. No bodies were ever found, and none of the survivors could say what had happened. For the rest of their lives, they had dreams, bad ones. They wouldn't talk about those either, except one woman. Confessed to a priest of Sendovani before she died. Young, like all the rest. They say the Magi in the Conseil suppressed the hell out of whatever that priest wrote down. So it's just as well that Elderglass doesn't need maintenance, my friend, because nobody in Carthane has climbed the sky vault span since.
Bloody charming, muttered Locke, staring up at the elegant dark silhouettes blotting out stars and clouds. Gods, he was reciting horror stories to himself. Hardly suave and collected behavior. He needed to calm down, and he hadn't had the foresight to bring a quarter cask of strong wine. Footsteps scuffed the stones behind him, and he whirled, neither suave nor collected. Sabitha was alone. She wore a dark scarlet jacket over chocolate-brown skirts, and her hair was tightly bound around her lacquered pins.
"You look as though you've been listening to the stories about this bridge," she said.
"My, tavern master," said Locke. "When I got your note, I asked him if he knew anything about the spot you picked.
Seems it's not a popular corner of the district." She smiled and moved closer. "I thought we could do with a bit of privacy."
"Haunted Eldrin detritus does tend to secure that. Sly woman. I would have gone with something like a private chamber at a fine dining establishment, but I suppose I'm hopelessly conventional." A carriage rattled past, onto the creaking deck of the bridge. "What's on your mind?"
"I appreciated your letter," she said, gliding closer with that seemingly effortless dancer's step that made it look as though a wind had just nudged her along. "And I don't mean that as the usual oatmeal-tongued sort of polite acknowledgement. I appreciated what you said and how you said it. I'm beginning to think I might have been hasty in the way I treated you when you first arrived in Carthane."
"Well, even if drugging me and putting me on a ship was something of a personal misstep,
I think we can agree it was a valid approach from a professional perspective.
I admire that equanimity.
She was within arm's reach now, and her hands were around his waist. He couldn't have defended himself if he'd wanted to.
I'm not uneasy with you, you know. It's not you, it's...
I know, said Locke. Believe me, I understand. You don't have to... She slipped her right hand up behind his neck and pulled him so close there wasn't room for a knife blade to pass between them. Next came the sort of kiss that banished the world to distant background noise and seemed to last a month.
"Well, that you can do,"
Locke whispered at last. "If you feel you have to, I'll, grudgingly refrain from stopping you."
"It's nearly midnight," said Sabitha, running her fingers through his hair. "Not much left now but the casting and counting of the ballots.
Were you planning on attending the last big show at the Carthenium?" "Can't miss it," said Locke. "Too many hands to hold. Yourself?"
"There are private galleries looking down on the Grand Hall. Once you've given all your children suitable pats on their heads, why don't you and Jean join me to watch the returns? Ask any attendant for the Sable Chamber."
"Sable Chamber, right. And, now you seem to be wearing that there's something amusing I'm not telling Locke face."
"As it happens, I did hear the most fascinating thing."
She took his hand and led him to the very edge of the embankment wall.
"One of my conseil members privately complained that someone broke into his manor and, if you can believe it, stole the reliquary shelves from his ancestral chapel."
"Some people should learn to lock their doors at night."
"I found myself pondering the purpose of such an unorthodox acquisition," said Sabitha. "I concluded that it must, in all probability, be an attempt to exercise some sort of hold on a man for whom the theft of less personal trinkets would have no real meaning."
"I'm disheartened to learn that your speculations took on such a cynical character."
"Conseillers of Carthane shouldn't have to worry about outside influence on the eve of an election. Don't you agree? I felt compelled to make inquiries and issue instructions to the constabulary. Merely as a matter of routine civic duty, of course.
Everyone knows your deep attachment to the civic health of Carthane goes back quite a few minutes," said Locke.
"There it is, nearly on time."
Sabitha pointed down to the water, where a canopied pleasure barge emerged from under the sky vault span. A long black constabulary launch was lashed alongside the barge, and blue coats with lanterns and truncheons were swarming it.
"That's the Plain Delight. Belongs to a friend of one of your deep roots conseilers, I believe. I also believe that the reliquary shelves in its hold will be back in the hands of their proper owner before the sun comes up. Any particular comments?"
"I can neither confirm nor deny that you're a sneaky, sneaky bitch," said Locke.
"You're my favorite audience."
Sabitha leaned in and kissed him again, then broke off with a grin.
"Sable Chamber, tomorrow evening. I can't wait to see you. And I'll have a discreet escape route prepared, since I think a lot of irate deep root supporters are going to be looking for you once the ballots are counted."
Interlude. Death Masks. 1. The next sound in the room was that of Donker attempting to fling himself at the door, only to be caught and pulled back by the combined efforts of Alondo and the Sansa twins.
"Gods damn it, you brick-skulled hostler!" Jasma growled. "If the rest of us have to suffer through this farce, then so do you!"
"What's the name of this harling of Bulidazi's?" said Locke.
"Nerissa Meloria," said Jasma. "Used to be a lieutenant in the Countess Guard. Now she's sort of a mercenary, hard as witchwood and cold as Azaguia's cunt plumbing."
"Where's she meant to take the money after the play?" said Locke.
"The hell should I know, boy?"
Jasma ran his hand slowly over his rough stubble.
"His lordship might have been screwing me, but it wasn't the sort of affair where we had pillow talk afterward, know what I mean?"
"I'd bet my life he'd have told her to bring the money to his counting house," said Janora. "It's at the Court of Cranes, not far from his manor." "No retrieving it from there," said Sabitha. "I'll have to work up another note in Bulidazi's hand and send her somewhere more private."
"She will still expect to deliver the money to him," yelled Moncrane. "And she'll expect a signed receipt, and she will rather expect him to have a pulse when he signs it."
"Well, she's not working for the Countess now," said Sabitha.
She's not an agent of the law. She's Bulidazi's by hire, and she'll bend to his eccentricities. All we need to do is contrive some that will make her leave the money and go away satisfied.
Well, Amadine, Queen of the Shadows, what do you suggest?
Jasmine waved his hands in elaborately mystical gestures.
Magic? Pity I'm only a sorcerer on stage.
Enough, shouted Locke. The sand is running into the bottom of our glass, and no fooling. Leave the details of the money switch to us, Jasmine. This company needs to move to the Pearl in good order, and all of you need to act as though the play is the only care you have in the world. Stout hearts and brave faces. Out!
The Moncrane Bulidazi Company shuffled from the room in mingled states of shock, hangover, and grim resolve. The Sansa twins followed. It had been Sabatha's suggestion that after the meeting they lurk conspicuously, leaving as few opportunities as possible for anyone to slip away.
"Any ideas toward parting this Meloria from the money?" whispered Sabatha.
"I've got one notion," said Locke, "but you might not appreciate it. We'd need you to play the giggling strumpet again."
"I'd rather do that than hang."
"Then we need to find out what the best bathhouse in the city is, and ensure that Baron Bulidazi has a reservation there after the play's finished." Locke rubbed his eyes and sighed.
"And please remember that I did warn you.
I think this is going to work, but it's not going to have more than a scrap of dignity."
2. "Demoiselle Galante, I don't understand."
Brego looked uncomfortable in finer-than-usual clothes, and he gestured with clenched fists as he spoke.
"Where the devils has he got off to? Why won't he simply—"
"Brego, please," said Sabatha. "I know where his lordship is meant to be later. As for the present, you know as much as I. Didn't his notes give you instructions?"
"Yes, of course they did, but I'm uneasy. I'm charged with my lord's personal safety, and I wish that I could—"
"Brego!"
Sabatha was suddenly cold and stern.
"You surprise me. If you have clear directions from the Baron Bulidazi, why are you in difficulty about following them?"
I suppose I have no, difficulty, demoiselle."
"Good. My own duties are about to become rather overwhelming."
Sabatha kissed her fingers and touched them to Brego's cheek.
"Be a dear and look to your business. You'll see what our lord is playing at soon enough."
The company had left the yard of Gloriano's, arrayed in some semblance of a spectacle. 3 black horses had been loaned by Bulidazi, caparisoned in his family colours, red and silver. Sabatha sat the first, side-saddle, and Chantal walked beside her, holding the reins. Behind them came Andrassus, tended by Donka, and Moncrane, tended by Alondo. The players on horseback wore their costumes, and Alondo wore a hooded mantle and a linen mask that left only his eyes bare. A cruel thing in the heat, but it couldn't be helped. The wagon, driven by Jean and Genora, had also been draped in red and silver, and was piled high with props and clothing. At the very bottom of the pile, shrouded and well dusted with scents and pomanders, lay the corpse of the company's patron. Galdo walked in the rear, juggling stingingly hot alchemical balls that spewed red smoke, while Locke and Bert led the column waving red pennants. Brego hurried off to his duties as Carlo, perched adroitly atop the rear of the wagon, began to shout,
"Invitation! Invitation! Hear our joyous declamation! The gods are kind to you today! Cast off your toil and see a play!"
Carlo sprang backward from the cart, turned in the air, and landed on his feet, neatly taking up the juggling of the smoke balls, which Galdo passed to him without a break in their rhythm. Galdo then vaulted into Carlo's spot and proclaimed,
"At last, dear friends, at last, the Moncrane Bulidazi Company returns in triumph to the Old Pearl. Come see, there's a place for you this afternoon. Don't find yourself bereft. Don't end the day mocked by your friends and turned out of your lover's bed as a simpleton. Hear the legendary Jasmine Moncrane, Espara's greatest living thespian. See the beautiful Demoiselle Verena Galante, the thief of every heart. Behold the luscious Chantal Cousa, the woman who will make your dreams her home."
So they continued, in this vein and in close variations, as the procession wound its way through the humid streets of Espara. The sun blazed behind thinning white ramparts of cloud,
promising a fantastic afternoon's light for the play, but little mercy for those who would strut the stage. 3. A bold green Asparan banner fluttered from the pole beside the old pearl, and the theatre was surrounded by noise and tumult. Alondo had explained to Locke a few days before how a major play attracted an ad hoc market of mountebanks, charlatans, lunatics, minstrels, and small-time merchants, though only those that made proper arrangements with the company and the envoy of ceremonies would be allowed within 10 yards of the theatre walls.
"Are you smarter than my chicken?"
cried a weathered, wild-haired woman holding a nonplussed bird over her head. At her feet was a wooden board covered with numbers and arcane symbols.
"Lay your bets! Test your wits against a trained fowl! One cop in a try! Are you smarter than my chicken? You might be in for a surprise!"
Alas, Locke found no time to dwell on the question. The Moncrane Bulidazi procession had to move on. Beyond the chicken woman moved the expected beer vendors with wooden cups chained to kegs, the trenchmen with shovels and buckets, the jugglers both clumsy and talented. There were harpists, shawm players, drummers and fiddlers, all wearing cloth bands around their heads with pieces of paper fluttering in them, showing that they had paid the street musician's tax. There were potmenders, cobblers and low tailors with their tools arrayed on cloths or folding tables.
"Sacrilege! Sacrilege! Ghost-bringers and grave-robbers! May the gods stop your voices! May the gods turn your audience from the gates!"
A wiry, brown-robed man whose face and arms bore the telltale scars of self-mortification approached the procession.
"Salarius lived! Orin and Amadine lived! You stir their unquiet spirits with your profane impersonations! You mock the dead, and their ghosts shall have their way with Aspara! May the gods—"
Whatever the man desired from the gods was lost as Bertrand shoved him back into the crowd, most of whom seemed to share Bert's opinion of the denouncer. The man was not soon allowed to regain his feet, and the company passed on. At last, behind everything, came the simple wooden fence at the 10-yard mark, patrolled by city constables with staves. Within the boundary, merchants, prosperous enough to afford tents, had taken places against the walls of the old pearl. The public gate to the theatre was guarded by a flinty woman in a blood-red gambeson and wide-brimmed hat. She kept to the shade, head constantly moving to survey the crowd, and she wore truncheon and dirk openly on her belt. The actual money-taking was being handled by a pair of burly hirelings. Locke spotted Brego hurrying toward the woman, folded parchment clutched in his hands. Locke suppressed a smile. That would be the sealed orders from Baron Bulidazi, the ones diverting Maloria and her weight of precious metal from the counting-house to the bathhouse. The company halted at the north side of the Pearl, where Moncrane's half-dozen hired players lounged under an awning. They leapt up, nearly tripping over one another in their eagerness to be seen offering assistance with the costumes and props. As Jean and Genora handed things to them, carefully keeping them away from the wagon itself, a woman approached on foot with a pair of guards at her back. She was young, sharp-eyed and heavy, dressed in a cream jacket and skirts trimmed with silver lace. Sun veils dangled from her four-corn cap, and to Locke she had the air of someone used to crowds parting and doors opening before her. Jasmine and Sylvanus confirmed Locke's suspicions by climbing hastily from their horses and bowing. In an instant, the entire company was doing likewise.
"Master Moncrane," said the woman, "do rise. It is agreeable to see you and your company gainfully employed again, if somewhat diminished in number."
"My Lady Ezrintame, thank you for your sentiments," said Jasmine, straightening up but icing his words with a thick coating of deference. "We have every hope that our recent loss of a few supernumerary players will prove a refinement."
"That remains to be seen. I had expected your patron to precede his company. Can you tell me where the Baron Bulidazi might be found?"
"Ah, my lady, as to that, my Lord Bulidazi has not confided his present whereabouts to me. I can assure you that he does have every intention of being present in some capacity for the afternoon."
"In some capacity?"
My lady, if I may, I cannot answer for him, save to assure you on my honour that my lord is labouring even now to ensure that today is not merely memorable, but, singular.
I shall, of course, be watching attentively from my box, said the woman. You will inform your patron that he is expected, following the performance, if not before.
Of course, my lady Ezrintame.
Moncrane bowed again, but the woman had already turned and started away. One of her guards snapped a silk parasol open and held it between her and the sun. Moncrane made his obeisance for another half-dozen heartbeats, then rose, stormed over to Locke, and seized him by the collar.
"As you can see," said Moncrane, speaking directly into Locke's ear, "Countess Antonia's envoy of ceremonies now expects a personal appearance from the very, very late Lord Bulidazi once we've taken our bows. What do you propose to do? Thrust a hand up his ass and work him like a puppet?"
"You will pretend to be Lord Bulidazi," said Locke.
"What?"
"I'm fucking with you. Why do you keep acting as though it's your problem? The play is your problem. Leave the rest to us and take your hand off me."
"If I end up facing the rope because of this," said Moncrane, "I'm going to ensure that I bring a merry fellowship along for the drop."
Moncrane stalked off before Locke could say anything else.
"I keep asking myself," whispered Sabatha, giving Locke's arm a squeeze, "are we smarter than that woman's chicken?"
"At the moment, it's an open question," said Locke.
4. Behind the stage lay a number of corridors and small offices, as well as two large preparation areas referred to as the attiring chambers. Stairs led to a cellar where hoists could be used to send players up or down through trapdoors. The air smelled of sweat, smoke, mildew, and makeup. The attiring chambers buzzed with chatter, most of it from the hired players. Bert and Chantal looked stern but willing. Alondo had his arm around Donka's shoulders, and Sylvanus was relieving a wine bottle of its contents. The twins were robing themselves for their joint role as the chorus, one in red with a gold-ornamented cap to represent the imperial court, and the other in black with a silver-chased cap to represent the court of thieves. Jean and Genora hung white robes and phantasma masks on wall hooks, there to be seized and donned in a hurry by that significant portion of the cast that wouldn't escape the play alive. Brego and a pair of servants came to retrieve Bulidazi's horses and colours. Once they'd gone, Jean took up a post at the back door. He would keep a close watch on the wagon and its sensitive contents, darting in to help Genora only with a few crucial or complicated operations.
"We're on at the second hour sharp," said Moncrane. "There's a Ferrari clock behind the Countess' box. When it chimes two, the flag dips. I salute the Countess, then it's out with the louts to tame the groundlings. And gods, will they need taming."
Locke could hear the murmurs, the catcalls, the shouts and jeers of the aspirants filling the earth-floored penny pit beyond the stage, as well as musicians trying to strain coins out of the crowd.
"Second hour of the afternoon," thought Locke. That left about 20 minutes for dressing and thinking. The former was so much easier. His Aurin costume was brown hose, a simple white tunic, and a brown vest. He wound red cloth in a band just above his ears. This would keep the sweat out of his eyes and suggest a crown even when he wasn't wearing one. For the early scenes at the court of Salarius II, Locke would wear a red cloak over his other gear, a smaller version of the cloak that would be worn by Sylvanus at all times. Sabatha approached, and Locke's throat tightened. Amadine's colours were those of the night, so Sabatha wore black hose and a fitted grey doublet with a plunging neckline. Her hair was coiffed, courtesy of Genora and Chantal's expertise, threaded around silver pins and bound back with a blue cloth matching Locke's red. Her doublet gleamed with paste gems and silvery threads, and she wore two sheathed daggers at her hip. "Luck and poise,"
she whispered as she embraced him just long enough to brush a kiss against his neck.
"You outshine the sun," he said. "That's damned inconvenient for a thief."
She squeezed his hands and winked. Carlo and Galdo approached.
"We were hoping for a moment," said Galdo. "Over by the door with Tubby," said Carlo.
We thought a little prayer might not be out of order.
Locke felt the sudden unwelcome tension of responsibility. This wasn't something they were asking of him as a comrade, but across the barrier even the laissez-faire priests of the Nameless Thirteenth were bound to feel from time to time. There was no refusing this. The others deserved any comfort Locke could give them. The five Camorri gathered in a circle at the back door, hands and heads together.
"Crooked Warden," whispered Locke. Our protector, our father, sent us here with a task. Don't let us shame ourselves. Don't let us shame him now that we're so close to pulling it all off. Don't let us fail these people trusting us to keep them out of the noose. Thieves prosper. Thieves prosper, the others whispered.
Chantal came to summon them for Moncrane's final instructions. There was no more time for prayer or planning. 5. The green flag of Aspara came halfway down the pole, then went back up. Locke, watching through a scrollwork grill, signalled to Jasmer, who squared his shoulders and walked out into the noise and the mid-afternoon blaze of light. The penny pit was full, and newcomers were still shoving their way in from the gate. Attendance at plays was an inexact affair, and Nerissa Meloria and her boys would be taking coins until nearly the end of the show. The elevated galleries were surprised.